Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we trade your brain with weird and valuable science. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, Marta Comyn explains financial markets, data science, and comedy school. But first, here's news of nerves growing back. Optic nerves regrown in mice. Researchers at the Children's Hospital Los Angeles in California have regrown the long nerve cells in the optic nerves of mice with an experimental treatment that may one day help treat people with vision loss from glaucoma. The optic nerve is a bundle of more than a million nerve fibers that transmit signals from the back of the eye into the brain. Retinal ganglion cells extend the whole length of the optic nerve. Glaucoma can increase the pressure of the fluid inside an eye, crushing the optic nerve. The researchers have developed a mixture of eight chemicals that induce undamaged support cells in the retina, known as Müller glia, to turn into what appear to be retinal ganglion cells that grow into the optic nerve all the way to the brain and send signals. In birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish, Müller glia cells naturally transform into neural progenitor cells and then generate functional neurons to restore vision after an injury. But in mammals, this kind of eye repair doesn't happen after birth, just in embryos. In a previous study, this team had demonstrated that a combination of five small molecules, valproic acid, CHIR, Repsox, Forskolin, and IWR1 could reprogram fibroblast cells into light-detecting photoreceptor cells, which restored vision when transplanted into mice that had been blinded by the application of the toxin N-methyl diaspartate. In this study, they damaged the retinal ganglion cells, again with N-methyl diaspartate toxin. By adding an extra three small molecule chemicals, 5C plus noggin and IGF-1, along with S24795, to the five small molecules mixture that they used previously, the team developed a chemical combination that stimulates proliferation, migration, and transdifferentiation of the existing retinal Müller cells in the mouse's eyes into chemically induced retinal ganglion cells. The support cells become optic nerve cable cells, stretching all the way from the eye to the brain. When the team tested the mixture in mice whose optic nerves had been chemically damaged and then treated, the researchers saw signs of vision recovery starting 2 weeks afterwards and continuing for at least 4 months. The researchers measured electrical signals in the eyes of the mice and then in the brains of the mice to verify that signals were being sent. One of the tests involved mice walking across a transparent surface with what looks like a drop underneath on one side, known as the visual cliff experiment. Almost all the mice without glaucoma damage chose to walk on the side with no visual drop, but the mice with damaged optic nerves walked all over the place. They didn't perceive the side with no visual drop. But 45 days after treatment, 72% of the treated mice chose the side with no drop, indicating that they could see it. The researchers showed that when human Müller glia cells growing in a dish were treated with their eight chemical mixture, they turned into retinal ganglion-like cells. However, the researchers raised two potential obstacles for the same treatment to work as well as humans as it seems to work in mice. One is that the axons of human retinal ganglion cells have to grow a lot further to reach a human brain than those in mice do to reach a mouse brain, simply because humans are so much bigger. The other is that the structure through which axons leave the eye is damaged in glaucoma and might block the growth of new axons. An extra treatment might be required in such cases. This research reminds me of David Sinclair's research into restoring vision with a different chemical mixture in 2020. David Sinclair and his colleagues crushed the optic nerves of mice using forceps and injected a harmless virus into the eye carrying the genes for three cell reprogramming factors. The intention was to restore the cells in the eye to stem cells, which would then grow appropriately to heal the eye damage, as if they were embryonic cells. The injection prevented some damaged retinal ganglion cells from dying and seemed to prompt some to grow new axons, reaching back to the brain. The mice appeared to regain some of the sight they'd lost in a test involving moving black bars on a screen. In addition to treating glaucoma, the Children's Hospital Los Angeles team plans to test whether their eight chemical mixture approach to transforming glia support cells into retinal ganglion cells could help treat a rarer condition called optic nerve hyperplasia, in which the optic nerve fails to develop properly, which can lead to blindness in young children. It's also possible that this treatment could help people whose optic nerve has been physically damaged. But for now, the research team is focusing on glaucoma and optic nerve hyperplasia. Hopefully, this research will progress beyond mice and be used to help restore some vision to people who've suffered glaucoma. The paper was titled "Vision Rescue via Chemically Engineered Endogenous Retinal Ganglion Cells" and was published in the BioArchive Preprint Archive for Biology, which means that it's still undergoing peer review.
You're listening to Ian Wolf on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on diffusionradio.com. Diffusion Science on the airwaves, spreading knowledge in a swinging way. From atoms to molecules, it's all in play. Tune in now, let's rock and sway. Diffusion Science, we're on a roll, exploring mysteries, heart and soul. Learning together, we're on the go. On the radio, let the knowledge flow.
Finance and data science. Marta Comin is a lecturer at the University of Adelaide Business School, and her area of research is market microstructure, trading and financial markets. She studies everyday market data to understand the effect of regulation. Marta teaches business analytics projects, which is a master's course that teaches students to analyze data for finance and business. Marta trained at the Sydney Comedy School's stand-up workshops, and she performed with other scientists about her research at the Adelaide Fringe Comedy Festival. I spoke with her by Zoom, and unfortunately, her internet connection dropped out many times. I began by asking Marta about her experience with the Sydney Comedy School.
The comedy was a chance to look at my research in very down-to-earth terms without trying to make it anything more serious than what it is, which is just using data to study things in financial markets. And I think data is useful in many contexts. I think it's probably socially useful in kind of the discourse that we are having in everything in life, because looking at numbers doesn't paint a picture that is tainted by opinion. It paints a picture of reality as it is. And I think that's what I really appreciate about using data. And in the context of financial markets, it just in the context of my research, using data is helpful to see whether, you know, a particular regulation, for example, in the stock trading is helpful to make trading easier for investors. Elsewhere, they apply also these tools in other contexts, like maximizing the portfolio returns or optimizing trading strategy. But in the context of the research I do, it's mostly to see what's useful overall as a practice in trading. And it can be useful from the perspective of like ease of trading, which is liquidity, or whether what people do in markets has optimal consequences for those people themselves or markets overall. Like, for example, in the case of the GameStop story that I talked a little bit about in my talk. I think, like, to me, comedy is like another tool of storytelling that strips the complexity of the topic and also gives me a chance to play a little bit with, you know, the different concepts and how to understand them. I think I only touched the very basics of a very crust of comedy. I can't say I really delve that deep into it, but I like to think that comedy is, well, it could be like almost a tool of psychoanalysis, if you like. Except people are paying you instead of you paying the people.
Do you think you might make your lectures a little bit more funny?
I already do some of that. I have a couple of sessions on, well, one of the things that I do is I look at helpful ways to visualize the data. And there's a lot of funny things in there, like, you know, all kinds of stories that you could tell with a graph that are not truly true. So I remember one of the sessions I had probably after my comedy show had this graph of COVID deaths, which is not a funny topic at all, but it had this clear seasonality and it appeared on the graph as if, you know, everyone was waiting until Mondays to die. So no one was dying on Sundays, or very few people were, and like everyone was just dying on Mondays. And I remember just kind of asking my students, you know, what do you think is happening here? Why is everyone dying on Mondays? And if it's truly, you know, Mondays is the day to die, what are we doing here? Our session is on Monday. Something along those kinds of lines. But I can see a lot of potential in incorporating funny bits into the course I teach here in Adelaide. It's like definitely the kind of visualizations is one ripe topic, but others, and people do comedy about those things. I know my partner was showing me some comedy on that. It's not like I came up with the context, the idea of that originally. But yeah, I have the topic on lying with the data, and there's a lot of ripe material there. Like, kind of, you can put numbers together or graphs together using data in such a way that just stirs all kinds of conspiracy theories. It's just really funny how you can tell that narrative, like supposedly with the numbers, but truly understanding kind of like what the numbers really mean is a bit of a deeper thing than just coming up with the most outrageous story that I can paint.
Was it
more so? It's in some ways already in there. Yeah.
So you tease the audience a little bit here, just for them to think about: were the COVID results skewed by when they were counting the deaths, when the statistics were collected, or?
Yeah. So the seasonality of that particular graph, which was the number of COVID deaths in Florida. Yeah, the way that the graph was pulled together was affected by the seasonality of both reporting, I think, and the way that hospital system works. So it's possible that on that occasion with COVID deaths in Florida, that reporting of those deaths had a delay. So over the weekend, there would be no reporting or very limited reporting. And then the data would enter the system on a Monday and it would be recorded on a Monday for both Monday, Sunday and Saturday. And then you just had a spike on Monday. Yeah.
Right. And so the same sort of data analysis for medicine is the same science that you use to analyze the markets?
Well, similar. The tools are slightly different, but that gets the same statistical concepts that we both use. So in all those research trials that happened for COVID, which is at the core, it's the randomized control trial design, where you assign people to a treatment in a control group. That is the, and especially when it's double blinded, so both the participants and the researchers do not know whether the particular person is in the treatment or control condition. So given a real vaccine or the placebo. So the same tool, like that's an example of a tool that is used both in medicine and in what we call randomized control trials in, say, international development or in by the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, in the US, when they assign securities to different groups. And one example of that was the tick size pilot that they ran in 2016. Where they tried to study whether increasing the tick size, which is the lower limit of the bid-ask spread, whether that helps increase liquidity in the stock market. So yeah, similar randomization principle, but just different underlying process than in medical research. Yeah.
And could you quickly define what liquidity is for the audience that haven't heard of that before?
Perfect liquidity means I can trade a large amount of stock without paying too much for doing so to the dealer or through executing through the stock exchange, limit order book. Large in size, cheap, and immediate. So I don't have to do so over an extended period of time, but I can execute that right away. But ease of trading is the simplest way to define it.
Hmm. And you mentioned the saga of the GameStop stock, which, as I recall, was between people organizing on Reddit and the big investors on Wall Street over a game company stock. Zoom cut Marta's answer at this point, so here's a quick explanation. The GameStop stock saga happened because hedge funds decided to short stock in the GameStop company, which means that they bet that the stock price would go down. This information was public. The people on the Reddit social media site felt that they were doing this not because the company was doing badly and the stock price would naturally go down, but that the hedge funds were colluding to manipulate the price of the stock to make money by forcing the price of the stock down, and that the hedge funds didn't care about the harm to the company or other investors. They saw big guys hurting little guys for profit, and decided they could leverage the number of readers on their forum to get involved, despite only having a small amount of money each compared to the hedge funds. So the people on Reddit started buying GameStop stock and advising others to buy it as well, to keep the price high. They were playing the stock market by the same rules, but going long on GameStop stock directly against the hedge funds. The result was that the price went up and the hedge funds were forced to sell their shorted stock at a loss.
For Reddit investors to say, hey, like we're gonna burn you on this one, because obviously the more the stock increases in price, the more incorrect your institutional investors are about their bet against the stock. And so obviously the more money they lose, and now let's not let the rich get richer, that suddenly becomes like a very tangible punishing tool. Okay, sorry about this.
That's okay.
I guess I got disconnected with the internet, but I think it's back.
And some of them were trying to refuse to sell ever. They were just going to keep hold of it and try and keep the price up.
Yeah, well, this. Lots of things going on here, right? There's this whole idea of, you know, like truly believing in the cause, or in this case, just in the stock. There's no financial reason to believe in that. But eventually, like, you know, the GameStop actually did well in terms of making use of that increase in the stock price, because like as a company, if you're experiencing that kind of influx of investors and buying your stock and pumping up the price, what you can do is,
yes,
you can issue new shares, and so you can kind of raise money at a better valuation. And I think I can fact check that, but I think they did do that, and they did use that money in doing some useful things and kind of in the real business sense. So it's not entirely useless that your stock price goes up. It can affect your actual business operations. But ultimately, like, GameStop is not, you know, something. It's not a high-end chips manufacturer or something that's really that's really going to make it big because of how hot the area is or how profitable they are right now and in the future based on expectations. Yeah.
When you talk about the microstructure of a market, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, it means several things. It means the machinery, so things like trading systems and matching engines of the stock exchange and the stock exchanges that exist, because usually it's a fragmented market. So it means all the infrastructure, let's say, that allows people to trade. It also means the outcomes of that and how we measure them. So things like how we measure this ease of trading, which I call liquidity, and how we measure what we call price discovery, which means how easy it is to incorporate information into prices. So how informative prices are from the perspective of saying something useful about the company's future cash flows. So again, by trading on information, I incorporate that information into prices. I buy a stock that I expect to have better future cash flows. I sell the stock that I expect to perform less well. So by doing that, I help the market perform its function, which is price discovery. And so these elements, the infrastructure of the market, so the actual systems involved, the ease of trading or liquidity and this function of price discovery, those are kind of the three key elements, I would say, of what the field of market structure is about. And I call it market microstructure. That's more academic term. In industry circles, it's called market structure. And it's about those three things, more or less. Yeah.
And how did you find the commodity trading to go on the other path?
Commodity trading, did you say?
Sorry. There's a whole other thing. I was thinking about the commodity school workshops that you would have done.
Right. Well, the commodity school workshops were wonderful. It was a perfect mix of, well, a practical tips for how to perform well in the public speaking sphere and how to make it funny. So I'm really grateful to David and Seton from Future Science Talks for training us up. So all up, we had four or five workshops, if I remember well. And it started from, you know, the general exposition of what comedy is and tips on how to write our script, which was about the first session. And I recall writing that script and rewriting it probably two times to kind of based on their feedback and based on how my understanding evolved of how to make things succinct enough and funny enough and also at the same time have a story to it. So I think there's different ways to do comedy, but in this particular case, I did want to have like the actual storyline to follow. Kind of fleshing that out was part of the exercise as well. And well, I think I emerged with a much better understanding of what's funny and why it's funny, and also understanding better, like if I ever were to dive into that world, how that differs from where I am, like where would I have to bridge the gaps? I saw a few more comedy shows, part of Adelaide Fringe, that, yeah, showed me kind of the new world. I didn't know that much about that world, even though I did do some improv back in Sydney. So improvisation, which is quite different, but that does overlap. Mm. And yeah, so really great overall.
That was part one of my interview with Marta Comyn about finance, data, and comedy. Listen next week for part two. And her finance data stand-up comedy show. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker, or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please rate the show on iTunes and Spotify. Tell your friends. Follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Mastodon at Ian Wolf. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including Tune FM at the University of Armidale in New South Wales, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, 4DDD in Dalby and the Darling Downs in Queensland, 4RPH in Brisbane, Denmark FM in Western Australia, 6GME in Gullari in Broome, Radio Adelaide in South Australia, Lofty FM in the Adelaide Hills, 2XXFM in Canberra, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, and Print Radio in Hobart. Diffusion is narrowcast on Indigo FM 88 in Northeast Victoria. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos, and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed this show, you can explore more than 1,300 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords, so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. You can also support Diffusion by buying from the Diffusion Science Etsy store. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.